Welcome to the inaugural episode of New Books in Global Conflict. I'm your host, Amarnath Amarasingham. Today we'll be talking with Christopher Powell, author of Barbaric Civilization, A Critical Sociology of Genocide, published by McGill Queen's University Press in 2011. What exactly is genocide? Is there a fundamental difference between episodes of genocide and how we go about our daily life? Or can it be said that the roots of the modern world, or civilization itself, has the potential to produce genocide? If the latter is true, then what does it say about us and the society we have constructed for ourselves? Christopher Powell, in his illuminating new book, Barbaric Civilization, provides new insights into these and related questions. For Powell, the idea that genocide is something that happens when civilization fails, or is something that should be understood as fundamentally different, or wholly alien, or outside of our daily day-to-day experience, is suspect. Rather, he links genocide and the human potential for atrocity to civilization itself. In other words, there are clues present in the modern world, as well as the modern state structure, that can help us better understand the process of genocide and what makes atrocities possible. To understand genocide as bad and civilization as good, according to Powell, continues to confuse the issue. If civilization can produce genocide, he argues, then civilization is not the unmitigated good that we often take it for. The resulting book is a theoretically sophisticated journey through a difficult and all too frequently misunderstood and controversial topic. So, Chris, thanks for joining us. Hope you're having a good morning.
Yeah, I am. Thanks. Yeah, you too.
So I guess we can start by discussing a little bit about your background, how you got interested in sociology to begin with, and more specifically on this issue of violence and genocide.
Well, that was part of what got me into sociology in the first place. I had an interest in human rights, and especially human rights issues in Latin America in the 1980s. I started my undergrad in 89, so those issues were pretty fresh. And I was also interested in militarism as a global phenomenon and in disarmament in the wake of the Cold War and there having been the possibility of global nuclear war. So those are the issues that made me want to study politics and society. When I was designing the dissertation project, I was sort of drawn back to that original interest. And I think part of the motivation was that in my study of discipline, I hadn't found a lot of literature that directly addressed the social dynamics of violence in a convincing way. And a lot of social theory is oriented to normative behavior. And I wanted to look at what happens when we get as far as possible from what's usually considered to be normative behavior. I thought that would work on two levels because that would let me investigate issues of violence, human rights, and it would also be revealing of an aspect of social structure that doesn't usually get looked at. That when we look at the thing in its extreme, we see something about how it functions normally.
And so by normative behavior, you mean?
Sort of day-to-day, comfortable, middle-class North American life. The situation when people are obeying the rule of law, when things are going as they're supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was the thing that jumped out once I started looking at the literature on genocide is that the literature assumed that genocide was a kind of social breakdown, that it was a society falling apart in some way. That was kind of the framing assumption for the material that existed when I began the research, which is I started doing the research in 1999, no, actually a bit later, 2002. At that time, there hadn't been a lot written that's come out in the last 10 years about the roots of genocide in modern institutions. And I wanted to correct that assumption that genocide is a product of social breakdown. I thought, what if we look at how it's produced by normal institutions? What would that tell us about normal institutions and what would that tell us about genocide?
Right. Is there is this part of your doctoral dissertation, this book, or is it something that came after?
Yeah, I grew out of the doctoral dissertation. Part of it, too, is that actually I wanted to write a work on theory and to address pretty big theoretical questions, and I wanted people to read the book, and so I needed to make it about something. And I couldn't think of anything more compelling for me personally or for a potential audience than genocide.
Right.
You spend a little bit of time in the book situating yourself in terms of describing your background and not only why you chose to write the book, but your ethnic and racial positioning, I guess. Why did you feel the need to do that?
Yeah, that's an important issue in social science. The default attitude is that we're producing knowledge that's objectively valid, and to do that, we try to minimize our own subjectivity as much as possible. So we remove ourselves from the picture. And that's a way of writing that conveys an impression of unshakable authority. And I had intellectual and political criticisms of that position. As part of the theory that I was developing, it's assumed that one always writes, one always produces knowledge from a position within social relations. Now, there's no objective, universal standpoint that a researcher can assume or even approximate. And so it was intellectually important to indicate my point of entry into the issue, that my own relationship to the issue is part of what is generating the knowledge that I'm producing, and so it's information that the reader needs to have.
Mm-hmm. It's not generally something we find too much in the study of genocide or in political science, right? Is it more of a kind of recent sociological position, phenomenon where authors tend to situate themselves or at least become conscious of where their positionality is?
Yeah, for me it comes directly out of feminist theorizing. Specifically right. Dorothy Smith, who is a huge influence on me, even though I kind of only really rely on one work of hers, Conceptual Practices of Power. It changed my whole orientation to social science, and I use her in the book. But yeah, it's that it comes out of that feminist critique of science, and so the impact of that is pretty recent. So I wanted to help, too, on a political level, perpetuate that. I wanted to help push my fellow scholars to think about their situatedness and their relation to their subject matter and make that explicit and to help encourage readers to expect that.
Mm-hmm. So the title of the book kind of touches on your broader argument, I guess, which we'll get into a little later in the interview, but I wonder if you can unpack some of the terms that you use in the subtitle, which is a critical sociology of genocide. Mm-hmm. So we'll get to genocide in a bit, but what do you mean by critical, and what do you mean by sociology, and why is that perspective a unique perspective to bring to the study of genocide?
It's funny because part of me wishes that I had subtitled it A Radical Sociology of Genocide. I didn't quite have the chutzpah to go through with that. I was a little worried that would alienate some readers. I was probably wrong. It probably would have been better to do that. By critical, I wanted to convey that it's a work that's not just looking at genocide itself as a phenomenon, but that it's using genocide to raise critical questions about the society that we're familiar with and aspects of society that we take for granted. And also that to use genocide as a way to raise critical questions about social science and the relationship of social scientists to the things that we study. So I wanted to signal that this was going to be a work that doesn't just look at genocide and leave everything else as it is. That by looking at genocide, we're going to be forced to reevaluate what we take for granted about the world around us and what we do. Mm-hmm. I would have liked to have called it A Radical Sociology because the goal was actually to theorize genocide, to understand genocide as a product of forces that go to the very root of the society that we live in, and that to really eliminate genocide from the world, if that's the ultimate goal, will mean changing society down to its very roots, and that it would require that. And that also, too, that it's a bit oriented to people who are not part of a political elite. That a lot of political theory, it's written in terms of, or a lot of political studies of genocide are written in terms of what should governments do about genocide. And I wanted to engage a bit with the issue of what do we do about genocide if we're not in government, if we're subjects. How do we approach understanding the issue and doing something about it?
When you say down to the roots, I mean that's a fairly heavy statement, I guess. So what do you have in mind when you say the very roots of our civilization?
I have to think about that for a sec. To explain that or to understand genocide. Sorry, I'm just having a complete brain fart because my mind went like three different directions at once. Part of what happened is that when I was doing the research for the project, and particularly when I was studying colonial genocide, I was reading David Stannard's book, American Holocaust, and just getting my head around the scale, the magnitude of genocide of indigenous peoples in the Western Hemisphere. It was really clear to me that this was not a marginal phenomenon. If the world as we know it, the modern world is formed through colonialism. It doesn't happen without colonialism. And colonialism, it seems clear to me, doesn't happen without a fair amount of genocide of indigenous people. It's not everywhere or in every instance, but it's a very common element of the colonial process. So the implication of that to me was that genocide was one of the constitutive features of the modern world. The modern world was created in part through genocide. So that's the first thread of that idea that it goes down to the roots. If it's a constitutive feature, then it's got to be there in the roots. And then so the implication was, and we should be able to find causal dynamics that contribute to genocide in the normal structures and practices of everyday life in modern Western liberal democracies. In other words, in the societies that are functioning closest to that normative ideal of Western civilization, we should be able to look at their routine functioning and find processes that help us understand how genocide gets produced. And so I looked for those at the level of the institutional structure of the state and at the level of how individual subjectivity is formed. So there's an element in our everyday practice of the self that makes genocide possible and then gets mobilized when genocidal violence is brewing. And that's that element of subjectivity is something that's historically specific. It's not a human universal. It's a cultural product.
Yeah. So under that view, we all have a kind of residue of the way in which our modern state structure was created, that has as one of its components the some past injustice or past genocide that led to the construction of that state.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the simplest way I can put that is that one of the necessary elements of genocide is the exclusion of the other from the universe of moral obligation. It's a phrase that sociologist Helen Fine made popular, although she actually picks it up from Durkheim, exclusion from the universe of moral obligation. In order to commit genocide, a person or group of people has to be defined in such a way that we have no moral obligations to them. And that the capacity to do that is part of our habitual mental toolkit. That we have a capacity to define others as evil or as abject, and therefore to absolve ourselves of any moral responsibility to them.
Right.
So, I mean, the figure that kind of fulfills that at the moment in Western culture is the figure of the terrorist. Mm-hmm. The terrorist, you know, almost by definition has become somebody who's just absolute evil, who one can do anything to. And so we have these you know, you watch Jack Bauer on 24, and it's this fantasy about being able to torture and murder the terrorist over and over again. That habit of thought, it's we don't put it into practice very much in our everyday lives, but it's a potentiality that's there.
You make interesting use of heroes like Hannah Arendt and Zygmunt Bauman, who's one of my favorites, and Norbert Elias, I guess. So, I mean, where did you feel that their previous kind of work on genocide, especially people like Bauman, what did you take from them, and what did you feel needed to be critiqued?
Bauman was really useful for me. He really made the whole project possible. What Bauman and Arendt both have in common is that they're willing to look at the Holocaust in particular and perceive it in non-mythological terms, rather than seeing it, the genocide of Jews as, it's kind of instance of Satan incarnate, seeing the Nazis as insane or demonic. They're willing to look at how these are in many ways quite normal people doing things that are in many ways quite normal. Eichmann shuffling papers in an office, making decisions about how to allocate resources, requisitioning parts for trucks, is part of what makes the Holocaust possible. And Bauman really develops a nice argument about how modern bureaucracy distances the individual from the moral consequences of their action. So when right. when the Nazis on trial at Nuremberg kept saying, "Well, I was doing my job," the moralistic reaction to that is that's a terrible cop out. You should have known that your job was wrong. But Bauman takes seriously the experience of the bureaucrat who is following procedures and doing a job. And that's socially, historically distinctive. The modern period makes it possible on an unprecedented scale for there to be these large organizations where people perform impersonal routine activities which can have these terrible consequences, atrocious consequences. And I was interested in that impunity, that we have a tendency when we see a great evil to assume that there's a great evil intention that goes along with that, matches the evil of the outcome. But in genocides of indigenous peoples by colonizers, sometimes you find evidence of a kind of a casualness. Like, the genocide happens as, the Columbus's extermination of the natives of Hispaniola, in a sense, it kind of happened because it was easy to do it. It didn't right. take a great intention. And the Holocaust is this frightening similarity that for many of the people involved, there didn't need to be a hatred of the Jews or a strong ideological commitment to Nazi racial doctrines, because the structure of the situation just made it participating in genocide into the path of least resistance for people. And the moral consequences of their actions were offstage, so they didn't have to confront them. It's that kind of event where the way that a social situation is organized and structured makes it possible for people to do extraordinary things, things they would never do otherwise, that really fascinates me.
So do you see that functioning even in the kind of contemporary society as well, or is it more?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. In many contexts, when, shareholders of a corporation make a decision about an investment that's going to ruin the lives of hundreds or thousands of people because they're going to lose their jobs and by extension lose their homes, lose the life that they've been building for themselves for two decades because, a factory is no longer profitable. There's that same distancing that's at work and that same impunity that the costs of the action are not being borne or even witnessed by the people who are making the decision.
But you wouldn't go so far as to say that it is a kind of genocide. But you're saying that those mechanisms are always present and on our daily basis that make genocide possible.
Or
acceptable.
That's one instance of the kinds of mechanisms that continue to make genocide, all kinds of violence possible. And I summarize that in the book in terms of impunity, that people have the power to make decisions that have effects on others without being meaningfully held accountable for those decisions. That's the underlying way of summarizing all these kind of very different situations of disconnection, and it's behind not just genocide, but many kinds of violence.
Yeah, I mean, if you listen to interviews done by bankers and stuff during the 2008 meltdown, you hear similar arguments of, I was just doing my job in terms of derivatives and all that kind of stuff. So there is a kind of bureaucratic distancing that makes injustice rationalizable, I guess, if that's a word.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, I mean, and they're not lying. Like, they are just doing their jobs, and if they don't do their jobs, then they will pay a price. In terms of they might lose their jobs, lose their standing in the community that matters to them, and that's what's real for them. That's what's part of their experience. And so one person to keep their world sacrifices, maybe thousands of people who lose theirs because of an investment decision or what have you. And But the two are removed from each other. So that person who makes that decision isn't accountable to the people who suffer. And so the implication, what I'm demanding is, on a broader level, is a society where we are all more accountable to each other than we are. Mm-hmm. And that's that means a deep reconfiguration of society. You couldn't make the shareholders or the banker responsible to, working people on an assembly line in a factory in a blue-collar town without far-reaching consequences for how the whole economy operates. You couldn't make, there's efforts to make, the United States president responsible for the consequences to citizens in Iraq or Syria or Latin America. I'm thinking back to the 80s, countries where the United States makes foreign policy interventions. But whenever the accountability becomes real, it changes the whole dynamic of politics. And of course, I mean, the American president is at least more accountable than like the Russian president. So the project of accountability and opposing impunity has the potential to change the world that we live in. And I wanted to frame it in terms of impunity and power, not normativity. For me, it wasn't a question of what are the norms that govern us. It's the question of what are the practical ways in which we are accountable to each other. Once that accountability is there, then we'll develop the norms. Now, for me, a crucial part of the analysis, and this is a shift from the mainstream of sociology or from the mainstream of sociology that dominated in the field when I started the work, I wanted to shift away from seeing society as a normative order. For a grassroots or a democratic politics, the message is people who are engaged in work for change is don't focus so much on the on a normative regime and look at what power relations are making the situation possible.
Mm-hmm. So is there something Western about your argument, or do you see it applying to developing countries or other countries where these kind of structures may not have been present?
Well, yes and yes. One of the influences for me is a project called World Systems Theory associated with Emmanuel Wallerstein. And Wallerstein looks at the global political order as a system. So although we all nominally live in different societies, all these societies are governed by nominally sovereign states. So the state as an institution is global. There's no part of the world that isn't, well, where people live that isn't governed by a state, except like research stations in Antarctica. States are interdependent. The existence of any one state is necessarily interconnected with what's going on in all the others. So the whole thing forms a system. So the point that I'm making is that this is the globality of Western civilization. It has its roots in historical development of Western Europe, but that civilization is now global. I'm fundamentally disagreeing with, say, Samuel Huntington, who talks about clash of civilizations, because he's defining civilizations normatively in terms of cultural codes and stuff. He can get away with saying that there's these multiple civilizations, and there's Western civilization, and then there's like Islamic civilization. But if we look at civilization in terms of its institutional structures, there's only one anymore. The others have all been absorbed. So it's a Western-centric argument, but it's about a Eurocentric or a Western-centric world that we now live in. This European institution, the sovereign state, has been exported everywhere. So I'm hoping, yes, that the argument applies as much to developing countries as to the West.
For example, the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia or something, these are more kind of incidents, I guess, of genocide or events of genocide. So for your broader argument in terms of the functioning of society itself, how would you apply that to these kind of flashes of genocide, I guess?
Yeah. I was talking about habits and the ability to exclude the other from the universal moral consideration. But the other dimension of that is sort of the macro dimension, which is the state. And the state, I'm looking at it as the organization whose fundamental, sine qua non, it's the thing that it can't exist without, is its monopoly over the means of violence. In that sense, we can understand the Khmer Rouge genocide in terms of the exportation of the Western state, the sovereign state, to that that country. And here I'm really influenced by a book called White Man's Burden. It was written by Basil Davidson. He was looking at the Western state as an institution in Africa, and its instability and its failures. You take people who've been governed by political authorities that had a different form than the sovereign state, and you impose the sovereign state on them with its monopoly of force and its ability to tax and reconfigure the economy through direct intervention that comes out of its monopoly on force. And political questions arise that didn't previously exist or that have previously been settled in some way. So who controls the state is incredibly, incredibly important. In Cambodia, the question of who controlled the state became unsettled in the post-colonial period. And the Khmer Rouge, once they took control of it, one of the difficulties that I think that they had is that they had very little legitimacy outside of their original constituency in the eastern part of the country. And the only resource that they had to maintain their hold over power was to exercise the state's fundamental function, to use violence. So the genocide has this quality of trying to use, when all you've got is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. The Khmer Rouge managed to seize hold of a monopoly of military force in the country, but they didn't have relationships of legitimacy that enable the state to minimize its use of force. So that combined, with other factors in the situation, made the escalating use of force and increasingly indiscriminate use of force marginally, it gave it a marginal utility, that for every problem that came up, using violence seemed like the most expedient solution until the country was immersed in a bloodbath.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, even though it's we're far removed from Western Europe, I'm looking at, and there are cultural dynamics particular to Cambodian society, and Alex Hinton's written about them very well, that are really important in that situation. And the dimension of it that I'm looking at is how the Western model of the sovereign state contributes to the problem.
So the Western model, even when it's not a Western country, so to speak.
Yeah, even though it's not, no.
Yeah.
But as a post-colonial country, the form that its political institution had to take was the sovereign state.
Right. So maybe a little bit on the last word in your subtitle, which is genocide. How exactly has genocide been defined in the past, and where do you see some of the definitional setbacks that you were attempting to fix or grapple with?
It's really complex, the history of how genocide is defined. Almost everybody who writes about it has their own definition.
Right.
There's, of course, the United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide is the most widely recognized definition. It is international law. And everybody has their quibbles with it. Everybody has their disagreements. Some people find it too broad and want to restrict genocide only to mass murder, because there's provisions in the convention that imply that you can have a genocide without committing mass murder, or without really killing people, for instance, just by removing children from a group. And then there's people who find it too narrow because it only focuses on certain means of committing genocide and the exclusion of all others, or it only focuses on racial, religious, national, or ethnic groups and leaves out, for instance, groups defined by political identity. So that if I decide, as you know, president of Indonesia, I'm going to murder 500,000 communists, which happened in the 1960s, then that doesn't meet the UN convention definition. But for me, also part of the problem was it stressed the role of intention too much for my purposes. I wanted to look at genocide as a process, and for me in general, I want to look at social processes in ways as things that exceed the intentions of the people who participate in them. So I don't want to be too restricted by people's intentions. It's like if, for instance, we're talking about, to pick a completely different topic, we're talking about racism in the media. And if I say, well, I didn't intend that comment to be racist, therefore it is not racist, a lot of people will find that really unsatisfying. In generalizing from that kind of intuition about things, I wanted to get past intentions, although I understand why you need to have intentions in a legal definition. If you're going to prosecute individuals and punish them in a judicial process, you kind of need to have intentions in there. But I wanted to look at it as a sociologist. So I ended up defining genocide as, and this is terrible, it's really abstract and wordy, an identity difference relation of categorical obliteration.
Which
I really regret not finding a more accessible way to put that. I wanted to define it as a relationship and to focus on how it's a process that unfolds through a relation. It's an identity difference relation because it involves the definition of self and other. And sometimes genocides actually create those definitions as they're happening. So the genocide of communists in El Salvador and Guatemala in the 1980s, the communist was to some extent just created out of thin air, not completely out of thin air, but largely the manufactured by the perpetrators of genocide. Or, like, famously, the Nazis defined Jewishness in a way that had, you know, went way beyond how actual Jewish people experienced Jewish identity. So the self-other distinction gets generated through the process of violence. I wanted to define it in terms of categorical obliteration because, for me, what's striking about genocide is the erasure of a collective identity through violence.
Right.
It's not about the killing of people per se. That's not, for me, the target. It's the identity of the other that has to be destroyed. So even if people physically survive, as long as their collective identities been erased, then that's...
And what are some of the ways in which this collective identity can be erased?
Well, in the case of the Armenian Holocaust, expulsion and dispersal of a community. So the Turkish government during the First World War physically expelled the vast majority of its Armenian population from the country. A lot of people died. A lot of people were killed. Or were put in situations where their, you know, death was likely. It was a very violent process, but a lot of people also survived. And this was at one point an argument against calling it a genocide because there were a lot of survivors. What for me made it a genocide is that this collective identity of Ottoman Armenians was destroyed through dispersal. People could no longer relate to each other as members of that community through the sheer force of their physical separation from one another, as well as the destruction of the institutions that had made it possible for them to have a life together. Another is removing children from a group and re-educating them. So in Canada, the Indian residential school system was designed openly with the purpose of removing children from Indigenous families, raising them to be, you know, Anglo-white Canadians with Indigenous, you know, physical features, white children in brown skins. So that, in part, so that the Indigenous cultures that they came from would cease to exist or would cease to be an obstacle to Ottawa's plans for developing the country.
Mm-hmm. Under that definition, would you say a kind of a process of assimilation, even, or a policy of assimilation, can have those kinds of consequences?
It can. Assimilation is a slippery word because it, you know, it can mean you're going to help somebody who comes to this country and they speak, you know, I don't, Ukrainian, I'm half Ukrainian on my mom's side. They speak Ukrainian and they're used to Ukrainian ways of doing things. And you're going to help them like learn how to operate in Canada and how to find a job and how to like get housing and, you know, get a bank account and all these things. And they're going to assimilate to Canadian society. And it's basically a benign process, or it can mean, we're going to take children from their parents. We're going to use force and deception to remove legal custody of children from their parents, and we're going to raise these children to hate the culture that they came from, to be ashamed of their Indigenous heritage, and we're going to try and release them in a world where they will no longer even want to have any connection to their parents, their aunts and uncles, to the community that they came from. So those are pretty extremely different phenomena, and they're all covered under the word assimilation.
But I guess the difference, again, is this tricky issue of intent, right? What was your initial intent in the process of or the policy of assimilation? And then isn't the difference based on this notion of intent?
Well, I talk about intent with respect to the Indian residential schools because it's convenient, because it's there, and that makes it easier for people to connect with, that we can find these sort of open statements you know, saying, I want, you know, to eliminate, like Duncan Campbell Scott saying, I want to end the Indian problem. But what I'm really more interested in is the consequence. So when I write in the book, and I don't write much about residential schools in the book, there's like a page about Canadian context. I don't want to mislead anybody. But in the book, I do write about Tasmania. And there's this really interesting play of intent in the British treatment of Aboriginal Tasmanians. Because there is an attempt to, I mean, first there's a war, an informal war between settlers and the Tasmanians. And the government sort of waffles over whether it supports the settlers in this war or whether it's trying to protect the lives of Tasmanians. It's kind of, is indecisive about that. And then there's an attempt to physically round up all the Tasmanians that completely fails. And then there's an attempt to entice them to voluntarily relocate to a community where nominally they're going to be fed and protected. And that succeeds, and they are relocated. And then have a community where they're given inadequate food and housing and subjected to all kinds of cultural re-education, they begin to die off. The outcome is the destruction, almost complete destruction, of indigenous Tasmanian identity. The intent is really murky. The intent seems to kind of want go all over the place, depending on the twists and turns of the situation. The outcome is really clear, and in a sense, it would have been clear to people at the time, and there were people who were identifying what was going on. But you're hard pressed to find some policymaker in a position of decisive authority who was standing up and saying, "Oh, we should just get rid of these people." You'd find people writing into the newspapers in Tasmania saying that that should happen, but the policymakers weren't saying that. But their actions spoke louder than their words.
There's a point in the book where you kind of describe the three dimensions in which genocide takes place, and I'll just kind of quote from it. I think it's page 12, where you say, the possibility of genocide results from social relations operating along three dimensions, the identity difference, the impunity interdependence, and interest indifference.
I wonder
if you can unpack what those three are about.
Being cutesy and putting a lot of eyes in there because I thought that would make it memorable. I wanted to come up with a, you know, for the positivists in the audience, I wanted to come up with a clear predictive matrix, something that could be falsified. And so those three axes the identity difference axis is something that's always present in social life. We're always defining social identities on the basis of difference. Who we're not is as important who we are as the things that we actually do, and then people always form groups. But there has to be a fairly strong polarization of us versus them for genocide to take place. It has to be it has to become a binary distinction, so that there is people who are them are absolutely not also us. That's, you know, an extreme situation. Like typically in social life, people are them and us at the same time quite often. You know, like, my friend, you know, one of my best friends is a Roman Catholic. I'm not Roman Catholic. So he's them, but he's also us because we're buddies and we hang out. And there's like an overlap between these categories. They're not, it's not a binary opposition. But in genocide, it becomes a binary opposition. There has to be the impunity to commit genocide. And I really wanted to focus on this, that it's a power imbalance that makes it possible. So one of the biggest things that we can do to prevent genocide concretely within the existing social order is to oppose the impunity of states to commit violence. And I think, other genocide scholars agree with me that generally supporting human rights in general, supporting democratic accountability in general is an important part of creating a world without genocide. And there has to be an interest in it. And this is the Marxist part of me. I wanted to connect the analysis of how and why and when genocide happens to the analysis of the social interests that are being served. So even though when people instigate genocide and leaders of genocide try to motivate others to engage in the project, they may deploy very heated, charged rhetoric about identity, personal grievance, ideology. Always, for the thing to happen, there's some practical interest that's being served. It doesn't happen just because a group of people in a fit of irrationality decides to hate another group of people. Somebody is benefiting from instigating the project. Probably their followers who participate are also benefiting in some practical way, and we need to identify what those interests are. So, you know, if a group of people, if there's contempt, if there's radical othering, but there's nothing to be gained, there might be a lot of violence, discrimination, oppression, but there won't be full-blown genocide. That's the argument that I'm making. And the flip side is, what is gained, and how is genocide actually productive for people? So what gets produced, what gets generated? One of the things that genocide helps to accomplish for its perpetrators is it gives the perpetrator group this tremendous sense of solidarity. You know, we're joined together in this project. And I think the fact that it's atrocious contributes to that, that we're joined together in doing this terrible thing. I think that might feed into the productive quality of genocide. When people, you know, on the ground, when people participate in atrocious acts together, it can be a very strong bonding device. And it's one of the collective gains at the level of society as a whole that I think motivates genocide. So with those three axes, it's partly about predicting when and where genocide is going to happen, and partly at the same time a way to investigate what I think are the factors that help us understand it.
The second part of your book is all case studies, kind of providing evidence, I guess, for your broader argument in part one. I don't want to get into every single case study that you discuss, but maybe you can talk a little bit about why you chose these particular countries and maybe just elaborate on two, I guess, maybe India and Rwanda or something like that.
Mm. Sure. Something I haven't actually talked about before is the idea of what I call in the book differentiation. I'm kind of answering another question that's on the list that you showed me, but that hasn't come up because it's a really important part of the book. To make the link between how a state does something and how individuals do something, I proposed that there's a kind of an emotional economy that connects people and binds us into a state. And it's economy based on deference. So that we have, and this is expressed in our social norms, so that we have an understanding, an intuitive understanding of who we should defer to, who we should give authority to, and who we should demand deference from. And what's important about this for the purpose of the state is that these relations of deference between individuals form a coherent whole. They form a coherent network with the sovereign at the top. What sort of drives all of this deferring is the threat or the potential for violence. In our own everyday lives, it's symbolic violence that we're most afraid of. We're most afraid of being, like, humiliated or embarrassed. Yeah. So, you know, in a really minor setting, at the dinner table, I commit a faux pas, I'm embarrassed. But, you know, if I fail to defer to the right person, like on the job or in an institutional setting, I might get, humiliated by that person, treated like a child. And then the most extreme form of that is if I fail to defer, you know, to the police or the army, you know, I might get arrested or worse. And without that economy of deference, the state can't function. It needs, it needs that. In cases of genocide, it becomes impossible for the victim group to defer enough. We def- people accept our deference because they get something out of it. When they no longer need anything from us, when the gains of perpetuating violence against us outweigh the costs, or outweigh the gains to be had from tolerating us, then violence becomes possible. In Rwanda, we had a really charged situation that accumulated over the course of like 100 years. Even in the late 19th century, a situation remarkably similar to Western Europe was developing in terms of the formation of a sovereign state and the demand the Tutsi aristocracy for deference. Under the colonial administration, initially that was intensified and charged. The state became stronger and more powerful. The demand for deference became more extreme. And then immediately in the process of decolonization, the symbolic relationship was flipped so that Hutus were put in charge and Tutsis were now expected to be the deferential ones. And it created this deep ambiguity, this uncertainty that persisted for decades. The fear, the anxiety for Hutus was, are the Tutsis going to return and reassume their dominant role? And are we going to get, is deference going to be demanded of us? The on a psychological level, the reason that's terrifying is it represents a destruction of the self. When the self is built up in terms of a particular conception of your place in relation to deference, to be demoted is a destruction of that self-image, of that social self. Middle class and like quasi-elite Hutus could really fear the possibility of a return of the Tutsis to power. And not just in terms of the practical consequences, well, I might lose my cushy job in the government, but in terms of the destruction of their own selfhood. So that was part of, I think, what made the ideology of Hutu power possible. And then at the concrete level of control over state violence, over the sovereign's monopoly of force, of course, that was very much in question. The civil wars always put that into question. For the Hutu perpetrators, and for the genocidaires, genocide was a means to accomplish, to resolve both of those problems at once, to decisively eliminate the challenge to the sovereign's monopoly on the means of force, and also at the same time decisively remove the threat posed by Tutsi identity, the possibility of a restoration of Tutsi authority. And that struggle had the stake that it did because of the modern state in Rwanda. And Rwanda is actually a highly bureaucratized society where the state is very, very strong. The level of social surveillance and state intervention in day-to-day life is formidable. So the question of who controls the state is really important because that sovereign will have a decisive impact on every aspect of day-to-day life for all Rwandans. If another solution had been found to how to organize post-colonial Rwanda, then the problems and the challenges would have been different. But you're asking about India too. But does that?
Because you have three different kinds of categories here in part two, and I was just wondering, how you're approaching, colonized, this notion of colonized others and the national others and ideological others, right?
Yeah. Let me just think about that for a sec. I wanted to look at Rwanda and Turkey partly because they're very mainstream in the literature. Genocide scholars, there's a lot of literature on comparatively on Rwanda and and Turkey. Of course, there's the most literature on the Holocaust, and in the book I actually stayed. I didn't make the Holocaust a case study. I talked about it, but there's so much written about it that I wanted mostly to focus on lesser-known episodes and episodes that are some of which aren't even really considered genocide. So the paired cases of Tasmania and India are both instances. First of all, colonization and genocide happening through colonization in different ways, and specifically British colonization, because in the history of colonization, the British often come off as like comparatively decent when you compare them with like the Spanish or the Portuguese in the Americas. The British seem relatively benign, and I'm always wanting to unsettle our assumptions about good guys and bad guys, and to actually break down that binary opposition and look at, instead of looking at identities, look at practices. So that was the logic that guided that choice of including India. And because it's barely a genocide, I don't know anybody else except Mike Davis who argues that it's a genocide, or that it, or he uses that term, and he actually uses the term Holocaust, which is not quite the same thing as genocide. So I wanted to look at it. Can we have a genocide that happens accidentally or in a completely unintended way? Both of the cases of colonial genocide, Tasmania and India, were like that. But India the most, because there's nobody who's standing up and saying what we want to do is engineer a famine because we want to subjugate these people. Nobody's saying that. The famine comes about through the application of rigorous free market policies towards the agricultural economy. First of all, the commercialization of what had been a subsistence economy, which makes people dependent on the market for their physical survival, where previously they hadn't been. Before colonization, there were famines, but there were two important differences from after colonization. First of all, in a subsistence economy, famine happens more directly because of ecological disturbances. But also, Davis argues that the governors in India attempted relief efforts to mitigate the effects of the famine. That was something that the British colonizers actively prohibited in their attempt to marketize the rural economy. They made illegal and made active efforts to stop even charitable relief efforts to make sure that nobody got any food who couldn't afford to pay for it.
I guess a related question is, how much of the definition of genocide needs to be adopted by the community or group themselves? In other words, if as you say, a genocide happens accidentally, does the group to which it happened have to kind of know that happened to them does there have to be a self-understanding that they were victimized, or is that not really necessary? Again, it's more consequences, but who determines the consequences, I guess?
Yeah. On a practical level, yeah. If the group to whom this event happened don't find the concept of genocide useful, then as a scholar, me calling it genocide isn't going to go very far. And that's really important in the context of Canadian situation. Ultimately, I can say as a scholar, on these and these bases, the word genocide is applicable to what happened in Canada. But whether we're going to call it genocide or not ultimately has to be decided by Indigenous people. The point of the concept is to protect people's dignity and advance their their vitality and viability as bearers of culture. If the word genocide is counterproductive because of the political dynamics and that, the backlash that it produces or whatever, then it, you know, it's not the right tool for the job.
Mm.
But yeah, in the case of India, you know, Mike Davis's argument in his book *Late Victorian Holocaust* was an indictment of sort of liberal capitalism, and for me also, I'm wanting to use the concepts in order to look at the kinds of systemic destruction that get produced when there are these situations of gross impunity, when people's lives become the fodder for a social experiment, or when something like mass famine is the byproduct of social policies that are aimed in a, you know, at in a completely different direction. They're aimed at empire building and whatever. And it just happened that people's lives mattered so little that the Clinton government could keep on doing what it was doing. I want to ultimately to get us to question our trust in these normal institutions, the comfortable faith that we have, that we live in more or less the best possible world, and that more or less those who have power have it because it's beneficial for us that they have it. I want to question that confidence.
It's great. Very interesting. I'm sure the book will attract much interest. What has been the reception been like so far?
It's been interesting. It's been picking up steam. I've had kind of a lukewarm review from Martin Shaw, who's a pretty authoritative spokesperson for the mainstream of genocide scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't surprised by that. Like, we have a different worldview. So, but I've had many individual scholars express their appreciation for it. I had a really nice review that appeared in the Journal of Genocide Research by somebody who really got it. People involved in Aboriginal activism here in Canada, some of them have expressed a really strong appreciation for it, which I found really moving. Even though I don't write very much at all about Canada in the book, people I've known have found it useful. So I feel like it started off on a good note, but not overwhelming, and it's just been kind of nicely progressing and picking up steam.
What is your next project looking like? Are you remaining in kind of genocide studies, or are you moving in other directions?
I'm actually, the argument of the book ultimately implies that what matters is the question of how we deal with force in society and how we deal with difference. And what I want to look at next is at the opposite end of the spectrum. I want to look at voluntary, non-hierarchical social movements. Movements like Occupy, mm-hmm. Where there's a conscious attempt to make decisions collectively without hierarchy, or without any fixed hierarchy of people in institutional positions anyways. And there's a fundamental question of difference that comes up in those movements that I think they are really having trouble handling. If you're, say, trying to organize an anarchist or quasi-anarchist movement based on spokes councils, and everybody who comes into the room is more or less on the same page, they have a common ideological orientation, then things go comparatively smoothly. But when people come into the room who don't have those assumptions in common, then it seems like these movements keep hitting roadblocks. How do we deal with the people in our movement who, for instance, want to be sexist and they buy into the economic goals, but they have unreflective sexism? Or what do we do with people who are showing up at the Occupy camp who aren't activists, who are homeless people, and who have a completely different life background and from the middle class activists who are, you know, constituting the camp? Like these kinds of questions about what to do with people who are like very different from one another, and how can we use this process to translate difference into some kind of effective action? Do we ultimately have to be the same? Do we have to have a common ideological or normative framework in order for an effective politics to happen? That's the kind of question I want to investigate next. So I'm going to be looking at those kinds of social movements, looking at co-ops, in general trying to investigate this question of what happens when people try to make decisions together collectively on a fundamentally egalitarian basis. What kind of roadblocks do they hit? And what can we learn about how to make those efforts succeed more effectively?
Well, sounds great. I hope you'll come back and talk to us when that book or project is out and about. So the book, again, is Barbaric Civilization, A Critical Sociology of Genocide. And we've been joined by Christopher Powell. So thanks again for joining us, Chris.
Yeah, thank you.